Steve Heller with a Chorus 77 broadcast. For almost 2 weeks, I've been here in tropical Miami Beach, ensconced as a fellow in the climate-controlled vaults of the Wolfsonian FIU Museum, researching my forthcoming book, Iron Fists, Branding the Totalitarian State, to be published by Fiden Press. The Wolfsonian, built largely on the rich collection of Mitchell Wolfson, is a treasure trove of what he calls decorative and propaganda arts, and what the museum director and curators call design. Every day, I've been exposed to remarkable riches, not only for my purposes, the images produced by the 20th century's most infamous dictatorial regimes, but by other books and ephemera representing the broad range of culture in design. I'm here with Chief Librarian of the Wolfsonian Florida International University, Frank Luca, who has been my guide through the stacks, to talk a bit about this unique collection and the impact on the study of design the Wolfsonian has had. Okay, so Frank, I've been here for over a week in this wonderful collection, in this great library, researching for my own project. What is so special about this library?
Well, I think it's really unique in not only what we have here as part of the collection, but the focus that we have with this collection. For example, we have about 45,000 rare books. There are lots of rare book libraries out there. We have probably 200 rare periodical titles. Nothing special again. Lots of rare book libraries that have that as well. But we also have about 25,000 ephemeral items, things that weren't meant to be collected and saved because they were meant for one quick purpose and then meant to be balled up and thrown away. So that's one of the things that makes this special. So we have things ranging from any kind of small print format advertisements, calendars, fly swatters, all the way down to Valentine's and wallpaper samples.
And how, as a librarian, do you deal with these ephemeral items? I mean, most library schools will teach you to deal with books and to preserve books and how to sort out and taxonomize books. How do you deal with ephemera?
Well, it is a challenge, absolutely, because how do you preserve something that wasn't meant to last? Oftentimes printed on, you know, acidic papers using inks that weren't of the greatest quality, especially during years when there were major world wars being fought. So we have a, as is typical of special collections library, we have a two-pronged strategy. One is preservation. We have to make sure we can preserve these things for many future generations of scholars. So we make acid-free, lignin-free backings that will absorb some of the acidity out of some of these items. We'll put them behind mylar, which is a chemically inert polyester film that also protects it from the oils in our fingers so that they can be handled with care. And but we also want to make sure it's accessible, because if you preserve it and no one can see it, well, that really defeats the purpose.
Right.
So one of the things we've been doing is digitizing the collection as well and linking those digital images to records available on the web. Mm-hmm. So that way it's much more accessible, not only to people like you who have the privilege of coming down here for a visit, but someone who maybe is doing some scholarship far away around
the world.
Exactly, absolutely.
So let's talk about some specifics. I've been here for over a week and a half. I've been able to go online and find things that then come out of this magical place that you call the stacks, and boxes upon boxes of great ephemera. You mentioned the fly swatter before, and I was looking at the fly swatter, I was looking at fans, I was looking at razor blades. What would you say are the three biggest jewels of the collection?
Ooh, that's a tough one. There's just so much here, and it's so diverse that it really is tough to sort of...
Well, make your favorite, you know, go out on a limb.
Okay, I have a couple favorites. I mean, there's the DePero Bolted book, which is just really a masterpiece of futurist innovation, and this book that was designed by this artist who didn't want to go in the traditional norm, and it's got the most amazing graphics and typography for that time frame.
Something that's,
as far as
what about something that's, yeah, a little
we
less known?
We have a little postcard that was designed right after World War I by some of the people of the Austro-Hungarian Empire who were very upset about seeing their country partitioned. And it's a little mechanical work as well as a postcard. And you turn this little wheel and all of a sudden their country disintegrates and breaks up into small separate countries, so that it was very obvious how much territory they lost. So they could make this political statement and send this around. They were really upset that Wilson had sort of promised that, hey, this wasn't going to happen, and yet some of this was happening.
So a lot of the material in this collection, even the most ephemeral things, postcards and programs and flyers, have a real historical...
Absolutely. Kind of... I think sometimes more so than you find in the typical... In the typical art history museum, the emphasis is on high art, fine art. But this is the art that was the persuasive art meant to move the masses. And I think that really is what gives this collection such an interesting edge to it. This isn't... Some of it is beautiful art, amazing art, but the fact that it was just so pervasive and out there, and yet that's the kind of thing that gets forgotten first.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's then go and talk about the founding of the collection. Mitchell Wolfson, who is the benefactor for the Wolfsonian Museum and this library, I mean, he started collecting this stuff on his own, as a kid.
Absolutely. And collecting a lot of things that people first looked at him and sort of said, that's a little weird. Why would you collect that stuff? We're kind of embarrassed that it's still in the attic, in fact. Because he collected not only the beautiful isms of, for example, futurism or constructivism, these artistic surrealism, these beautiful artistic isms that you would want to preserve, but also some of the darker and what I call the uglier isms, things like fascism, totalitarianism, colonialism, things that we certainly are not promoting here in this museum.
And why did he do this? I mean, obviously, these are things that were thrown under the bed or kept in the closet or hidden in vaults in Washington. Why would he do such a thing?
I think he's not a hoarder by nature, as some collectors tend to be. He's a preservationist. And he realized that there's a whole generation of materials out there that were not being preserved because people were a little bit embarrassed by them. But they're so integral and important to our both our cultural and societal and historical heritage that he felt that he needed to be the one to start this because no one else was doing it.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself are a historian and a librarian, and you use the collection. I've seen you taking classes around, and you have little exhibitions out in the vestibule that kind of lead into other aspects of the collection. You did a whole show on colonialism. How did the collection play into your interests?
Well, I mean, this collection is what attracted me down here to Florida and specifically to work for this institution because I'm a cultural historian, and for me, this was a gold mine of material culture and all of the persuasive arts. And for me, I can't imagine teaching without this kind of material. I think as a historian, you'd be handicapped if all you're relying on are the written documents. Well, much of what's moved people in society has been that graphic image or an object, things that they saw in their everyday life. And these are the kinds of things, to me, that are absolutely important. So when I bring students through, I want to sort of make sure that they're visually literate, as well as just, you know, being able to read and make sense of documents.
Do you find that this is a revelation for them, or are they already primed because of our visual culture to accept this stuff?
I think the amazing thing is, although we are a visual culture, they're not taught necessarily to really dissect the image. Yeah, they're bombarded by these images all the time, but no one teaches them how to deconstruct it and make sense of it and see how they're being manipulated and what the colors are telling them, what the whether one woman is standing and another is sitting in the same frame. Does that set a sort of hierarchy there? So there are all sorts of things that we sort of try and do to get them to look at these objects a little bit more carefully and differently than they would normally.
Well, let's talk briefly and specifically. We're in a room and there's a whole table to my right of material on colonialism. And this runs the gamut. It's not just German, it's not just Italian, it's all over the place. How do you explain colonialism through these images?
Well, the wonderful thing about this collection is that you can make the connections and you can look at things comparatively and cross-culturally. There are probably better collections of Bauhaus in the United States. We have a good collection, mind you. There are better collections of Wiener Werkstatt, probably, but we have a great collection here. But nowhere can you see that juxtaposed to the Nazi art that displaces it. And that's the kind of thing that you can do here. And the same is true for colonialism. The course that I was teaching was on comparative colonialism. Here, I can look at the British Empire, the Portuguese Empire, the French, the Germans, the Italians, and I can get that entire spectrum, the Dutch East Indies, and we can look at it and say, how are they the same? How are they using the same strategies? How are they different?
And this is all through brochures and books and fans and advertisements,
absolutely,
correct?
And all sorts of commercial propaganda that is selling them on a box of Wheaties at the same time that it's selling them on empire and why it's great to be a part of this colonial project.
Now, I also saw, in closing here, I also saw that you had a class in and you were talking about World's Fairs. Now, I'm particularly fond of World's Fairs. I even did a book on the 39 World's Fair. How do you connect the World's Fairs to colonialism?
Well, there were specifically fairs that were colonial in their focus, the Paris 1931 Colonial International Exposition, but virtually all of the World's Fairs had colonial pavilions where these nations... This is sort of the darker side of exhibitions. We think of them as sort of, you know, fun theme parks where you go for entertainment and education. But part of that education was a little darker. It was propaganda meant to sell you a positive spin on essentially a very negative and kind of darker kind of campaign to subject other peoples to, you know, economic exploitation. But of course, you're not getting that when you're going to these fairs. You're seeing how we're bringing civilization to so-called primitive and savage peoples.
Right. And you're also seeing how design is changing the complexion of a country. Now, that leads to the Wolfsonian is really a design museum. It's a museum about decorative and propaganda arts, as they say, but it's also about design. How does, in your work as a librarian, how does design filter into this literature?
Oh, it's essential to what we have here. And design is actually, you can sell the worst product with great design. And I think looking at the Nazi movement is a perfect example of that. Bad product, great designers. So for us, it's really important to really focus on that design. It's not the ugly ism of Nazism, but how they were able to present it in a positive spin and get people to buy into that, that really makes this important.
So one last question, aesthetics. When you go through the material, do you look at it through the historian's objective eye, or do you look at it as there's some really amazing things in here, regardless of the context, regardless of the message that's being presented?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's almost impossible even for historians to be objective. I think it's best that we recognize our own biases and sort of know that we can never be fully objective, and that's maybe a little bit more honest. You look at some of this material, and we know too much. We know how things evolved in Germany and under the Third Reich, so it's almost impossible to remove it from that historical context, but you can when you look at an image and say, wow, that is just so powerful. I know why someone could be seduced by this.
Thank you, Frank. And this is Steve Heller for Core 77.